This episode of Linoleum Knife is brought to you by Film Movement Plus.
This week, Film Movement Plus presents What She Said, The Art of Pauline Kael. Director Rob Garver's look at this groundbreaking figure. Kael was likely the most personal and powerful movie critic of the 20th century. In a field that has historically embraced few women film critics, Kael was controversial, witty, and fiercely discerning, and her decades-long birth of The New Yorker energized her fans and infuriated her
What's up with you and your ability to speak?
Infuriated her detractors. That's not.
You.
That's not a phrase. That's a prank.
I'll tell you something. We're going to keep doing these ads. Maybe you could run through it once before that, you.
That's not.
What if we.
You're not wrong.
What if we.
You're not wrong.
After 10 years of doing a podcast, behaved in a slightly more professional manner.
People would wonder what they hit to.
I'm very sorry, Film Movement Plus. This is what you paid for.
Infuriated her detractors.
She was kind of mean sometimes.
On a weekly basis. Well, sure, we all are. Anyway, What She Said, The Art of Pauline Kael, is one of dozens and dozens and dozens of extraordinary documentaries,
yeah,
foreign films, indie features, shorts, you name it, they got it.
They got it.
Film Movement Plus, a streaming service that you ought to know about, and they want you, the Linoleum Knife listener, to know about it, and they're making this special offer. Get 30 days free trial, plus 50% off your first three paid months using the promo code KNIFE at checkout. That's KNIFE, KNIFE. Or as they say in that Alfred Hitchcock movie, the knife.
Which Alfred Hitchcock?
It's an early talkie.
Oh, right.
This woman's talking and all the other woman hears is the word knife because there's a stabbing thing.
Oh, I see.
Got anyway, filmmovementplus.com. That's where the action is. Check it out. And now the show.
Hey, we have theme music. Here it is.
And everything.
You know this song. You love it.
A podcast of the cinema.
Starring me, Dave White. I'm a film critic. I used to be a film critic for money in writing, then came...
But now you are a film critic in making talkie words.
Then came the virus. You, your name is Lonzo Duralde. You're a film critic who's currently employed in writing film criticism, which is... shocking.
Go figure.
You and seven other people in the United States.
It feels that
right
way
now
sometimes.
For
yes.
The wrap.
Yes.
Furthermore, you're the co-host of Breakfast All Day and Who Shot Ya and A Film and a Movie. That's actually the name of a podcast.
It is.
A Film and a Movie.
Yes.
It's like, y'all might as well have just called that thing The Movie Podcast. Like, it's...
It is a challenge to Google, I grant you.
It is a really good podcast.
It
though.
Is
you
a really good podcast,
it with,
if I do say so myself.
You co-host it with
Daniel Thompson.
Daniel Thompson of the Deck the Hallmark podcast, and y'all have had a string of luminaries.
We have.
You guys are turning into the Desus and Marrow of film podcasts.
Nothing but illustrious guests.
Nothing but illustrious guests, yeah. Like, all you have is, like, famous people on now. It's bonkers.
It's crazy.
I don't want any famous people on this podcast.
I know. And none of them are clamoring to be on.
I mean,
so we're in good shape.
I take that back. We've had a couple famous people.
Sure we have.
But like, you know, we knew them before. Like,
yeah, exactly. It
we were just like, hey, friend, people know who you are. Do you want to come on our podcast? They're like, yeah, I guess so.
Yeah, but like, we didn't ask them to come on because of their clout. You know, we asked them to come on because we liked them and knew they'd be
half the time they didn't even have anything to promote. We were just sort of like, oh, here they are.
Ta-da.
So anyway, this is a podcast of film criticism with us,
yes,
the two film critics who are married husbands. And last week, all we did was Boys of the Band. We weren't intending to do a one-film episode. It wasn't meant to be Mamma Mia 2.
Yeah, but we got to about like the 50-minute mark. It was like, oh, I guess this is what we're talking about.
Because the day we did Mamma Mia 2, we were like, we talked about Mamma Mia 2 for an hour.
Yes, and I still don't know how that happened.
And then we were like, oh, all right, well, that's the whole show. Goodbye, Mamma Mia 2. Hooray. I also have to say, one of my very favorite episodes that we've ever done. What was the name of that movie? Mamma Mia 2.
Here we go again.
Here we go again.
Yeah.
Anyway, so they were. Here's what it is: when a movie is extra gay, we wind up talking about it for a very long time. So we threw all these other films off to the side that we had seen. And, you know, it's fine, because this week all I did was watch one thing. So I don't have much to add to what we were going to do last week.
And, you know, it's...
You know what? It's fine.
And it's not like these things are all leaving your local theater. They're all
streaming.
They're
all streaming for you. They're all for you here, Damien. They're streaming for you.
One of them starts streaming tomorrow.
Which one?
Totally Under Control.
Hmm. That's tomorrow?
Yes.
Let's get into it.
Sure.
Ugh.
It's the feel-bad movie of 2020, because it's all about 2020.
It's more than the feel-bad movie of 2020. It's the feel murderously infuriated
that
movie
too.
Of 2020. Why don't you discuss it? Because you watched the entire thing, and I stopped looking at it after an hour and went into the kitchen and made dinner because
you
I was
let out
so
a deep sigh and
out
like,
of
I
my
can't
mind
even
yeah.
anymore. And I get it. I almost paused it just to go outside and like
take a breath. Right.
It's a lot.
Discuss.
Okay. So documentarian Alex Gibney, working with Ophelia Hartounian and Suzanne Hillinger, his co-directors on this project, have made a film that is coming out in October of 2020 about the COVID-19 pandemic and the United States government's reaction to it. So obviously this is a movie about an unfolding story. This is a film that doesn't really end so much as it stops.
And so much has happened since January that it feels not only like a historical documentary. It feels like a history lesson.
Yeah.
But it also will give you information that you did not have, because I don't know about y'all, but I watch the news every day. I look at the news every day. I read news every day. I see news on Twitter every day. I'm paying attention.
Mm-hmm.
And the level of information just washing over us every day, the sheer amount of horrifying news being thrown at us every day, not just about the virus, but about everything else, is enough to make your brain whoosh it away when you are done for the day and you start to forget what you even took in back in January, February, March, April. Well, here's a documentary here to tell you all about it.
Indeed, yes. So, you know, they basically have figured out a way to interview people either at a distance. They basically send a camera to people's houses and have them set it up.
People self-record.
Or sometimes you see people where they're talking to people who are behind a whole screen of
barrier.
Hygienic division.
And they have every reputable person, I think, except Fauci.
Fauci, I'm sure, was like,
he's in news footage. But people who work in, you know, epidemiology and people who work in the government who were ringing the warning bells and saying, we have to do this. You have to do this.
Hey, what's going on over here? Why aren't you doing this?
The man that a minority of absolute idiot jerks voted into the White House in 2016 took it upon himself to pretend like none of it was happening.
Yeah.
This was an intentional, A, cover-up,
mm-hmm.
B, ignoring of the problem, and C, prevention of actual good things happening.
Yes.
All of it intentional, all of it criminally negligent, and now 200,000 plus people are dead because of Donald Trump.
Yes. This movie is so up to the minute that it includes the revelation of the Bob Woodward interview. We find out in a title card at the end of the film that the day after the film was completed was when Trump announced that he had tested right. positive for COVID-19. So it takes us that far.
Oh, and by the way, is this your first episode of Linoleum Knife? Well, buckle up, because we hate that dude. And if you voted for him, we would prefer that you not even listen to us.
That's can live with that. So, you know, we, like you said, there's a lot of sources in this film, people who are inside the government, people who deal with epidemiology or just statistics in general. Yes. And I certainly learned a lot of things I didn't know. For example, Dr. Bright of the Department of Health and Human Services,
yes.
who played a key role in a lot of this stuff and then, of course, got drummed out when he, you know, spoke the truth too loudly.
Anybody who did anything remotely resembling responsible behavior either got fired or were, like, frozen out of their, you know, responsibilities. Yeah.
So Dr. Bright launched a, like, a fire drill, a simulation, basically, yes. of what a pandemic would look like and how would we respond to it and where are we ready for it and where are we not. And he did this in the fall of 2019.
Mm-hmm.
So before all this happened, but not so long ago that the findings of that simulation weren't thoroughly relevant.
Right.
And that simulation found issues with the PPE and issues with other aspects of things and how to deal with it and blah, blah, blah.
Mm-hmm.
And he took his findings to Azar his boss, who promptly ignored them.
Right.
And then once this all started coming down for real, you see where the U.S. response is almost immediately bobbled because Azar tells Trump, well, this could be a thing, but we've got it under control. And apparently Trump only heard the we've got it under control.
No. It's not that he only heard that. It's that he chose to only listen to that.
Well, yes.
Make sure we say it right.
Okay. Well,
make sure we talk about what a piece of garbage the president
is. I'm paraphrasing one of the interviews in the film. That's
right.
How they put it.
Okay.
And, you know, and
then
and,
I'm here to correct that.
Fine. And then, you know, you get all of Trump's sort of magical thinking. If it's going to go away, so we're going to wake up one day, it's just going to be gone.
Right.
Which is not the case, and that's not how epidemics work. But then you see South Korea, who had faced public backlash in 2015 over how the government dealt with the MERS virus,
uh-huh.
and they were ready to go. They had systems in place. They had, you know, all this stuff happening, and they faced it in a much better way than we did, and their numbers were much better, and they were able to bounce back, you know, in a way that we haven't yet. You know, we see the steps along the way of like why the tests were messed up and the whole hydroxychloroquine nonsense and, you know, how Fox News mentioned it 28 times in a day. And so suddenly the FDA had to like respond to it and say, look, it's not a thing. We
right.
don't, there's no testing that says that this is a thing.
Right.
It's like, did you ever read And the Band Played On?
I did.
It's like that.
And in fact. In fact, I read And the Band Played On before coming out.
I read it just as I was coming out.
I thought to myself, if you are going to come out and begin doing body things with men,
yes,
perhaps you should know every single thing that you can know about the situation that we all find ourselves in here in the late 1980s.
And the Band Played On.
Is this your first time listening to the show? We're both quite old.
Yes.
Yeah.
And the Band Played On is a book by Randy Schultz, great gay journalist, about the initial response to the AIDS pandemic in the United States.
Right.
And it is one of the main books that radicalized me, I think.
No, same here.
And not only did I come out, but I came out angry and, like, you know,
also
rabidly political.
Me too.
Because you read this book and you see everybody who could have done the right thing at a certain juncture in time, not doing it.
Right.
And this movie is sort of the same thing, where you see this thing that's unfolding. You have a few people who are, you know, you see these email threads that are going around between like people in the government, people not in the government, who deal with epidemiology, who deal with all these different factors that play in. And, you know, while you have Trump saying stuff like no one's ever seen anything like this before, the emails are saying things like it's going to be 1918 all over again.
Right.
So you have people who are predicting exactly what's going to happen. And then you have the other people who cannot be bothered to pay attention to what those people right. say because they're not interested in science and they're not interested in government actually doing anything to help people, because right. then that would screw up their narrative of government doesn't help people.
Right.
And so you just kind of watch this catastrophe in slow motion unfolding, but like you're the final girl, you know, right. it's a right. horror movie that you're living right now.
Yes.
And so,
the killer is chasing you.
Yeah.
Your only safety is staying inside your home.
Exactly. Yeah. So in my review, I kind of compared it to watching something like Wes Craven's New Nightmare,
right.
where it's a sort of metatextual horror film.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's what this film is, but it is very well researched, and given all the names and numbers and science terms and things that are being thrown around, it's very easy to follow.
Right.
I mean, it's tragic to follow, but it's easy yes. to follow.
It I did listen to the last half of it while I was in the kitchen making dinner. So I feel you know, pretty confident in continuing to talk about this film.
Sure.
But what really got me during the first hour was, again, like I said, all the information that we weren't being given, and you're seeing it all sort of locking into place in January, in February, in March, and putting yourself, and you cannot help but put yourself in that spot.
Yeah.
You know, where was I in January, in February, in March, and what was I doing? And I remember going to Kaiser in February to deal with an infected eyelid situation that I had. And it was all around us already. Like, they were already saying to people, have you been to Wuhan? Like,
right, or,
You know, and that's what they would ask you when you came in.
I remember that last time we went to Target before the real lockdown happened, and they were already sold out of masks and alcohol.
Everything was already starting to, like, melt down at the grocery stores and stuff. We all were there. But we didn't have the information that you're going to find when you watch this this film. And I want to reiterate the thing that you just said, that this is the result of a group of people in charge of a government that they actively want to dismantle.
Yes.
The hardcore right wing that has taken over the Republican Party, they don't want there to be a government. They want it to be as minimal as it can possibly be. And that is why, from the very beginning of his administration, key positions in government that presidents are supposed to fill were not filled, have never been filled. These are, you know, departments that just ceased to function, and things have been slowly falling to ruin, falling apart because of this man and his ideology.
Or, of course, departments that were shut down entirely, like, for example,
because they didn't fit the narrative of what they wanted to have happen.
The White House office that was supposed to deal with pandemics, that did deal with pandemics so successfully during the Obama years.
But they're gutting the Department of Education. They're gutting the Environmental Protection Agency. They're destroying everything they can from the inside so that it takes forever to rebuild if and when another human being comes into the White House that cares about that sort of thing.
And so they can point to and say, see, government doesn't work. You have to leave it to the you know, the marketplace.
Right. That we all stand to benefit from.
Exactly.
We meaning them.
Yeah. Not us.
Not Linoleum.
No.
So if you think you can deal with it, watch this documentary. And then tell your Trump-loving family to watch this documentary.
If they can still be reached and can't, don't
assume.
If you
even have a conversation with
anything
them at all
that,
about
that anything contradicts
anymore.
The Fox News version of events is automatically a lie.
It's called Totally Under Control.
Yes. It begins streaming on October 13th, and it will be streaming on Hulu beginning October 23rd.
So it's in theaters right now.
Correct.
It opened in what? At drive-ins?
Whatever theater. Well, there are pits
hey, honey, let's go to the Mission Tiki. and watch the COVID.
The idea that you would go into an indoor theater where you're already taking your life in your own hands to watch a movie about the thing that you shouldn't be in there to watch anyway.
Right.
Yes.
So it's in the theaters now. It drops tomorrow, which is Tuesday.
Tuesday the 13th.
The 13th on just any
streaming platforms.
Streaming platforms. And then it's going to be on Hulu.
On the 23rd.
On the 23rd of October.
We're all going to die.
I already talked about this. Forget it. We'll move on. I was going to talk about something stupid that I've already discussed.
Oh, well, please come up with some new stupid things.
I haven't come up with anything new and dumb yet for this episode.
I have faith in you on this one.
Dick Johnson is dead.
Yes.
That's another documentary.
Yes, on Netflix.
It's all
right
documentaries.
Now.
You know what? Here's a question for you.
Mm-hmm.
Whoever wrote that idiot article this week about why they should cancel the Academy Awards. But not for the reasons why they should really cancel the Academy Awards.
But like permanently.
But because by the estimation of the person who wrote this article, there aren't any good movies out. there haven't been any yet. None that are worthy.
Of
the name Academy Award. Now, of course, they're not going to cancel the Academy Awards. But I think it's really funny that so many of the best films that have come out this year so far have been documentaries.
Well,
and the...
I think that happens every year. I think it's just that I think it's been easier to pay attention to this year because there's been fewer other things getting in the way of seeing them.
Now, what I will say about this guy, before we talk about Dick Johnson is dead, what I will say about this dummy who wrote this article...
I thought it was a lady.
Oh, I don't know who... I don't know the gender or the name of the person who wrote the article. All I saw was I scanned it, and I was like, I'm not...
No.
I'm not participating in this.
Give all the awards to Kelly Reichardt. Move on.
Yeah. Like, there have been really, really, really great films that have come out this year. Many of them have not been from the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And many of them have been films that would normally be ignored by the Academy because they're small.
And they don't have movie stars.
And they don't have movie stars in them. And so that's going to be a fascinating thing to watch happen. Now, who knows? Maybe they're fixing to onslaught us with a bunch of, you know, middle brow Oscar movie kind of, you know, films starring, you know, Kate Winslet or whoever. And maybe that will be what winds up being nominated. But I don't know. I don't know what these films are supposed to be.
No, this is on their way. The only ones that I've heard about that have just been moved to Christmas are both very festival type films. One is Promising Young Woman, which premiered at Sundance this year.
Right.
And one is One Night in Miami, which I reviewed, that premiered at Venice and Toronto. This could be, I love the idea of an Oscars where it's first cow and never rarely, sometimes always duking it out.
You know,
top
she
prizes.
Dies tomorrow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the half of it.
Right. Who knows?
But
who knows what's going to happen?
But the doc lineup is very strong this year.
Dick Johnson is dead.
Yes.
This is from Kirsten Johnson.
Mm-hmm.
She is the filmmaker who made the acclaimed documentary Camera Person.
Yes.
And this time...
It's personal.
This time, it is the story of her own father. He is the subject of the documentary. And he is slowly losing his memory.
Yes.
To Alzheimer's.
Yes.
And she talks to him and says, "Would you like to be the subject?" And he, very gung-ho, let's live life, let's not beat around the bush kind of guy, says...
He's a psychiatrist.
Of course, yeah. He's a retired psychiatrist. And he says, yeah, because this is going to happen to me, and I want people to know.
Yeah, let's make a movie about my impending death.
Yeah. And they made a really sweet, engaging, watchable... And sometimes gruesomely funny movie.
Yes.
About this man's death. It begins, in fact, with a simulated version of his death, and we see these simulations over the course of the film. And he participates in the filming of these simulated versions, like all the different ways that you could conceivably die suddenly out in the world.
Not all of them,
but you know, an air conditioning unit from a window could drop 10 stories onto your head while you're walking down the street. Who knows? That could happen. You know, you could be attacked by somebody in the street or hit by a car or any number of things, and you could go. And so they, you know, punctuating the real narrative of this film are examples, you know, simulated versions with stuntman in a very verite way, where you see the stuntman, you see the production quality of it going on, you see him standing off to the side like, oh, that's the stuntman.
You see
killed.
The stunt guy learning how to do Dick's walk, you know. But then when it happens, it's still a shock. And you go, oh, no.
Because you're like, oh, no, poor old Dick.
It's a movie, you know. And then she also sort of like offers up a vision of like Dick in heaven, you know.
Right.
Where his, you know, Jesus washes his deformed feet and makes them whole. And
yeah, he was born with a physical foot deformity.
Yeah.
And it was something that he had felt embarrassed by for much of his life. And because he's this very sort of like, look, let's show it all. You know, you see the feet.
Yeah.
And this very sweet story he talks about when he met, you know, his wife. And he didn't want to show her his feet.
Right.
And she said, I don't care about your feet. So the sequence you were just talking about, the in heaven sequence, they're in heaven. It's a big fake heaven with clouds and everything. And they've both got masks on of themselves as young people.
Right.
And they're dancing. So dancers have taken, you know, the professional dancers are doing this dance as them, as young people. And it's very, very moving. And it weirdly, and I know you'll laugh at this because it's a film I don't like, but this film I don't like is one that you really dig. And there's one scene in it that I have never forgotten because it's the one scene that felt like something real to me. June Squibb in Love the Coopers.
Okay.
That Christmas movie that you like so much.
Yeah.
There's a scene where she's napping in a chair, I think, or on a couch. And the narrator, who you find out at the end is a dog. So annoying. The narrator of the movie says she's dreaming that it's 1942 and she's dancing with soldiers.
Mm.
And it just punched me in the stomach. Like, of course that's what you're going to dream about.
Yeah.
When you're 85, you know, you're dreaming of the person you loved when you were 20 and you were, you know, fast and dancy and, you know, all the
full
things that
life.
You were when you were full of life. Yeah. And that weirdly reminded me of that moment in Love the Coopers. Maybe I'll give that Christmas movie another shot.
Look,
with
it's
you
not
this year.
Great, but it's charming. There's a lot about it that I like.
So anyway, Dick Johnson is dead. We continue.
Yes, this is an unusual film in that it's about death, and I think that remains a taboo subject so often in Western culture. I don't think we talk about it enough, even though it is one of the few things we all have in common.
Unless you've seen the films Silver Lake Life or Frederick Wiseman's six-hour documentary about
hospice care
called Near Death.
Mm-hmm. But it doesn't come up a ton.
It does not. And movies, narrative films, certainly don't handle it accurately, responsibly, in any way resembling normalcy.
True.
But
what this does, what the category this movie does also fall into that I think we are seeing more and more of these days because of the changing demographics of American society is about adults taking care of their infirm parents.
Yes.
Because as all of this is going on and as this film is being made, Dick not only retires, but sells his gorgeous house in the Pacific Northwest in Seattle and moves to New York to live with Kirsten in her one bedroom apartment in New York that is next door to the two guys and her children. Like the
Wait,
her children
clear,
and their
clear up that clear up these yeah, relationships, sorry. Please.
They live in an apartment next door to Kirsten's two children and her two children's two dads.
Yes.
And I know there's a lot of pronouns in there. Anyway, so but and obviously we see his condition worsen over the course of the film.
Yes.
Wherein even the participation in it requires her to explain more things to him.
Right.
That no, this is fake blood, and you know, like that kind of stuff, and him growing more uncomfortable with certain aspects of it. So you know, that I think is a subgenre that we've been seeing quite a bit lately, and probably will continue to as people live longer.
I don't know how people are reacting to this film who've seen it, but it really, really, really just got me because my own mother spent the final 8 years of her life in round-the-clock nursing care at a what was known as a rehab facility, but it was a nursing home.
Yeah,
I don't think they like to call them nursing homes anymore. Yeah. I'm not sure why that is, but
I think a rehab facility it gives the impression that
you might leave
you get
someday.
Better and then
maybe
you go home.
You're gonna bounce right out now.
Exactly.
She had a massive stroke in the year 2004, and she passed away in 2012. And this happened in Texas. She lived in a nursing home by my neck, very like 10 minutes away from my brother's house. And I would travel to Texas about four or five times a year for like a full week at a time to visit, to go do things with her, to take her out of the nursing home and go to movies and restaurants and, you know, the mall and whatnot. And I told a story about it on KCRW early on. This was like 2006, yeah, 7.
On a show called Unfictional that you can still find online.
Yes. And the story was about the very first time that we went out somewhere and she lost control of her bladder.
Mm.
And it was, you know, harrowing at first, because here we are in public, and she's 65 years old, and she has wet her pants. And we didn't have extra stuff with us, right? So I took off my hoodie, and I covered her lap with it. I guess we were at the movies,
You were at the movies.
Yeah. We left the movie. Like, she was so upset that we left the movie. She's crying. And she kept crying like until I got her into the car. And I remember, here's a tip, a life tip for anyone really under any circumstances. When someone is crying and you hug them, let them decide when the hug stops.
Mm.
And furthermore, don't do the patting on the back thing, because what that means when you're patting them on the back is, stop crying, please. Please, could you stop crying? There. Don't be cry. Stop it. I don't know what came over me or how I knew not to do the pat, pat, pat that day, but I didn't do the pat, pat, pat. And I let it happen. And she cried until she stopped.
Mm.
And I said, when she stopped, I said, well, now we're going to take you back to the nursing home. We're going to get you cleaned up. We're going to change your pants. Everything's going to be great. You're going to have dinner. Next time we go down to the movies, we're going to bring an extra pair of pants and some of those granny diapers. I don't even know if you have any, but we're going to bring some. And it's going to be cool. And if it happens in public, no one actually is going to care. We'll just cover you up with my hoodie again. I have a lot of them. And they can be washed. And I got her laughing in that moment.
Yeah.
And we didn't even make it back to the nursing home. And it was like she had forgotten that it happened. Not because her memory was going, although that did happen later.
Yes.
But what I learned in all those 8 years was You just deal with it. Whatever's happening, you just deal with it.
Yeah.
And you make as best as you can the person that you are helping feel okay about what's going to happen, what's already happening, you know. And yeah. Oh, she wet her pants so many times after that, and she was just like, eh. But here's going back to the KCRW story. I told that story on KCRW.
Oh, I remember now. Yes. And
and people got really angry
yeah.
that I was exploiting her
yes.
somehow, that I was telling stories, embarrassing stories about my mother on the radio. And fortunately, other people who were listeners, you know, responded to those messages because it's in the comments and stuff. And there were other places where people were commenting as well. But pretty much everybody came to my defense. And because I remember thinking, wait a second, I didn't do this to like
mock her.
to mock. What do you, who do you, what kind of monster would I be if I were just here to like goof on my mother for wetting her pants?
Yeah.
Like the, so I'm, my original question is, I wonder how people are reacting to this. Are they thinking that this is appropriate or inappropriate? That he's a participant in this documentary where they are really having a fun, jolly time with the idea of death.
Right. I know that it won an award at Sundance.
Yes.
However, it is now streaming on Netflix, and as we have learned,
recently.
You can't trust that people understand what is on and in a Netflix movie if it's complicated, and they might
Right.
miss the larger issues.
Right.
So I don't know. I haven't seen any kind of public outcry of like, "How dare she?"
Well, it's because the Q people haven't figured out a way to exploit it. That's why.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But yeah, Dick Johnson is Dead, one of the year's best documentaries.
It's wonderful.
On Netflix, check
Yeah.
it out. Also, I know we've already reviewed it on the show, another one of the year's best documentaries, it's on Netflix, Crip Camp.
Oh, for sure. Crip Camp is amazing.
Yeah.
We talked about that. We talked about that way back in like February, March,
Something
whenever
like
it was.
That. But yeah.
Whenever it came out. What a great documentary is Crip Camp.
Yes.
Now, you've seen a couple things that I have not.
I have.
I've seen one thing that you have not.
That is
but
true.
But before we talk about those things. Linoleum Knife is also brought to you by we're just awash.
That's right.
With ads and sponsors now.
We've sold out to the man.
The nickels are rolling in. Y'all ain't even know. It's electric car time. Meaning that we would like to buy an electric car someday, but it's not happening right now.
Probably not. Brought to you by our friends at Ovid.tv, another wonderful streaming service that has an extraordinary lineup of independent film, international cinema, documentaries,
yes.
all kinds of things.
They were, let's be real, they were our first love.
Well, sure.
In terms of advertisers.
But we're poly now.
Film movie. Yes, we are now in a polyamorous relationship with Ovid and Film Movement Plus. And you can be too.
That's right.
Dear listener.
You don't have to choose.
You don't have to be torn between two lovers.
No.
Feeling like a fool.
Mm-mm.
You can get Ovid. And this week, we are highlighting, well, it's actually, they're highlighting. We're just telling you about what they're
yes.
highlighting. The Adventurers of Modern Art.
Oh, like you.
That's me. Well, as you know, Alonzo.
You are a next level art bro.
That is correct. Much to your chagrin most of the time. I can feel your eyes glaze over. And I don't even have to feel it. I can watch your eyes glaze over. But anytime I start talking to you about contemporary art and what's going on out in the world and who's doing what, you look at me like, how long is this going
to
take?
I like to think that I can simultaneously glaze
my eyes. Is this forever? It's like the kid in the backseat.
And roll my eyes.
It's like the YouTube kid and the dentist.
Is this forever?
Yeah. Anyway.
But this, however, I want to watch.
Oh, do you?
I do.
Oh, do you?
Well.
So you want to watch a documentary about art, is what you're saying, but you don't want to listen to the person you love more than anything else in the world talk about art.
Yes.
Fine. Oh, it's fine. It's fine. The Adventurers of Modern Art is an innovative six-part animated documentary series new to Ovid. It was a big hit in France.
Mm.
It is sure to intrigue lovers of modern art everywhere. Through illustrations, animation, and original archives, you plunge into artistic life at the turn of the 20th century Paris through the eyes of Picasso, Dali, Apollinaire, Man Ray, Kiki, and other luminaries. Ovid is also proud to make available Lorna Tucker's Amma, the untold story of the involuntary sterilization of Native American women by the Indian Health Service.
Hey.
That's harrowing. And relevant and timely, since the government of the United States is doing it to migrants at the border now.
Yes.
Also, there are documentaries on peace activists, on different self-help cooperative efforts in Canada, on the emotion of resentment and how it defines culture today.
Wow.
Featuring interviews with philosophers and cultural theorists like Peter Sloterdijk. And an intimate look at small-scale farming, both on land and by sea, at a family oyster farm in Australia.
Wow.
Where they say no instead of no.
No.
We're going to just keep on doing this. That's... across the episode spectrum. Like, all the...
every show we do, is got some reference to how they say no in Australia. Because we can't get enough of it.
What's the deal that you get if you subscribe to
such a deal? Use the code Linoleum. Take 50% off the first 3 months of your subscription. Use it at checkout at www.ovid.tv. That's O-V as in Victor, I-D as in David, ovid.tv. What have I seen that you have not seen?
The Glorias.
Yeah, oh, man. It has, talk about movies, things you flush out of your brain. Okay. This is a new film from Julie Taymor.
Yes.
About the life of Gloria Steinem.
Yes.
And the title comes from the fact that Gloria Steinem is played by four different actresses at different stages of her life. Mm-hmm. Most notably Julianne Moore as sort of like from the founding of Ms. Magazine to the present. But also
cool 70s glory.
Exactly. But also Alicia Vikander as sort of like collegiate, post-collegiate Gloria Steinem, like traveling through India, getting started as a journalist, going undercover as a Playboy bunny, that kind of thing. I'm a big fan of Gloria Steinem, and I think her life is a fascinating one.
Right.
And this movie, I don't feel, does justice to it. It's...
why not?
Well, okay, not only do they go with the premise of, like, having the various actresses play Gloria Steinem, which is not unusual necessarily for a biopic, they put all four of them on a bus together.
Right.
So they can talk to each other.
Okay.
Which is super gimmicky and very Julie Taymor, uh-huh. And it doesn't work more often than it works. And it just... beyond that, really just kind of feels like a very by-the-numbers biopic.
Compared to the Helen Reddy movie.
Okay. Similar, actually.
Okay, that's what I was wondering about, because that Helen Reddy movie...
was so rough.
May she rest in peace.
Yes.
Was very by-the-numbers in terms of its, like, approach to
yeah.
the life of a person who did, you know, significant things in the culture.
Yeah. Frankly, like, and I know that Gloria Steinem was not a fan of this and had some quibbles with the way that it approached various moments in history. I think Mrs. America was far more interesting. I mean, obviously, yes, it had 10 hours to play around with, so
yes.
go more into detail. But I'll tell you, if you're going to throw in something like the Women's Caucus at the 1972 Democratic Convention or the 1977, you know, National Women's Conference.
Right.
And talk about them with any kind of historical context and have even, like, you know, Julianne Moore talks about the 77 conference as being like a catastrophe, but then they never explain why it was.
Right.
Whereas Mrs. America, you get all the steps of like what it was supposed to do, how it wound up, what wound up happening, what repercussions it had, that kind of thing.
You don't have to go into detail and show it all happening.
No.
All you have to do is just give me two more sentences of what went wrong.
Exactly. Exactly. Just like a little bit of filling in the thing. And through no fault of Gloria Steinem, because it's her life. These are the things that happen. Through the fault of Julie Taymor.
I blame Gloria Steinem
for
not having a life that corresponds well to a biopic.
No, but here a thing that Julie Taymor does, and I don't think she's aware that she's doing it, but this is what I'm judging the results on.
All right. Okay.
Over and over, we see Gloria Steinem's growth as an activist and as someone as a citizen of the world.
Yes.
Through her learning from women of color about their trauma.
Okay.
Whether it is women in India talking about the horrors of the caste system.
Okay.
Whether she's going to the March on Washington and a woman who is there is complaining about the fact that there are no women on the stage and, you know, telling her everything about that happened to Fannie Lou Hamer.
Right.
And it's like, those things may well have happened, and they may well have happened exactly the way the movie depicts them.
Yes.
But out of a larger context of the many interactions that take place over a life.
Right.
The end result is a movie where a white feminist comes into her own because she is educated by women of color about the lives of women of color and their trauma.
Right.
And that's not a good look.
It is perhaps meant to suggest that she did, intersect her work.
Yes.
With the lives and the work of other activists who were not white women.
Yeah, that's the intent, for sure.
But, I mean, and clearly Gloria Steinem did that.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I'm giving her that because I don't know enough to know what happened.
She worked with a lot of black feminists in the right. in the era of...
Who plays Shirley Chisholm in this film?
No one.
What do you mean, no one?
Shirley Chisholm is not a character in this. Bella right. Abzug pops up
briefly. Because it's on 10-Hour Mrs. America.
Exactly.
Okay.
Bella Abzug pops up briefly. Is played by Bette Midler, who is no Margot Martindale.
Right.
Betty Friedan never appears in this. But, like, you do get Flo Kennedy, who is played by Niecy Nash on Mrs. America.
Right.
Here played by Lorraine Toussaint, who is the best thing in this movie.
Okay.
Loved her. Dolores Huerta pops up a few times.
All right.
You see Gloria working with indigenous activists. So again, like, I know what the movie wants to say about intersectionality and her sort of learning from different people and understanding that feminism is a community effort. But the way that it's presented comes off
not as... written or edited in a way that really amplifies that in an effective way.
Exactly.
Okay.
All right. So yeah, kind of a letdown. And I felt very gratified.
Aren't we all sometimes?
I know. I felt very gratified when I saw several women film critics whose opinions I value greatly also have the same issues with this movie. I'm like, okay, good. It's not just me being a chauvinist pig or whatever.
Yes, because that's what you are.
I know. Look.
The time. I'm constantly apologizing to people on your behalf.
I'm here to listen, Dave.
To everyone except me.
Well... You had your chance. What else have I seen that you've not seen?
Save Yourselves.
Save Yourselves.
Which
is fun.
Is fun and okay.
Yeah. It's right. It is...
A horror comedy?
Sort of.
Sort of horror-y, sort of comedy-ish?
It's more comedy than horror.
I see.
It is...
Tucker and Dale versus Evil kind of level comedy?
Not exactly, but it's basically...
A real good
movie. It is a millennial relationship comedy that happens to unfold in the middle of an alien invasion.
All right.
So you have a couple played by John Reynolds and Sunita Mani. They are glued to their screens. You know, their work, their life, their everything is all about, you know, being online, being on their phone. And they decide to borrow a friend's cabin upstate. So they leave the city. They're going to turn off all their devices. They're going to get away and unplug and really reconnect with each other.
Right.
And then the aliens show up.
Okay.
But of course, they're the last to know because they're out of the city. And, you know, so it's sort of like if a relationship comedy unfolded in A Quiet Place. Because they're out in the middle of nowhere, and it takes them quite a while to figure out, wait a minute, you know, like they finally have to, it's only when she cheats and starts and listens to her voicemails, you know, and kind of pieces it together with some other weird things that are going on. The two leads are very funny, and it's very sharply written. It's maybe a little long, like it's the kind of, you know, did we talk about the human voice yet, or are we saving that?
It has not officially been released to the public
right.
yet.
Right, yes. It's just been in festivals.
It's in festivals.
So I recently reviewed Pedro Almodovar's new film, The Human Voice.
We're sitting on that, and we're sitting on the new Chiming Lang.
Yes, right.
For the same reason.
Until folks can see it.
Yeah.
Anyway, The Human Voice is like a half hour film, and it's Tilda Swinton. It's an adaptation of a one act play by Jean Cocteau, and it, you know, you realize that the whole idea of movies having to be 80, 90, 100 minutes is purely a commercial consideration.
Yeah.
Like, there are all kinds of films at all kinds of lengths. And it's like, in this country, you have shorts, and they play festivals, and then if they get nominated for Oscars, you'll get to see them.
Yeah.
Or you get features, and that's it. Like, I have sat on a jury at a film festival of medium-length films.
Yes.
Where everything we saw was between, like, 45 and 65 minutes long.
Yes.
This movie, I think, would have been great at 45 to 65 minutes.
Right.
Because it kind of runs out of steam every so often, and it doesn't always deliver on what it's shooting for. But it gets a lot more right than wrong. There are some very good laughs in it. And I really enjoy the two lead performances. So it's worth checking out. Save Yourselves.
I saw something you didn't.
Okay.
Cecilia.
Based on the Simon and Garfunkel song?
S-I-C-I-L-I-A exclamation point. Cecilia.
Oh, like Sicily the country?
Correct.
Ah, okay.
All right. This is a film in re-release. Mm-hmm. It is from 1999. It is currently streaming on the internet. I gotta say, before I even talk about this, obviously 2020 has been this show.
Yes.
Clean podcast. But the thing that's been taking place in 2020 is an avalanche of restorations and re-releases set up in virtual cinemas. Like, almost every week, there's some old film that has been restored in a new, like, master and, you know, cleaned up and looks perfect. And you can, like, click on your laptop and watch anything. And that's how I got to watch Paulo Rocha's The Green Years a couple weeks ago. Mm-hmm.
What was the Armenian film that we talked about? The Lighthouse?
Mayak.
Yeah.
And so...
Victor und Victoria.
Yeah, like, it's just the sheer amount of classic film and, you know, unjustly forgotten film that has been, like, carefully restored and re-presented, perhaps for the first time, you know, if it was very obscure or it only played festivals, it never got a proper release, suddenly you can see it. Now, as you are aware, Alonso Durante, and perhaps the listeners to a lesser degree, unless they pay really close attention, I have spent the past several years digging into the work of Jean-Marie Strobe and Daniel Huillier.
Mm-hmm.
You responded with a miniature sigh. Because you are a bad human being.
We have reached the Brussels sprouts portion of the episode.
I'm going to tell you to take your mouth and close it while I do say this thing. Because you don't know about Brussels sprouts and how beautiful they can taste when pan-fried with crispy bacon. Nor do you know that all of the work of Strobe Huillier ain't Brussels sprouts.
Yeah, I'm not saying
that's right. I'm just giving you the look. I'm giving you a look right now.
Well, that's good radio.
I'm giving you a behave yourself look. All right. Well, are you going to behave?
I'm
good.
The floor is yours.
You are going to behave. Great. So in 1999. These two filmmakers, husband and wife, team, they worked for many years together. Jean-Marie Strobe is still alive. He's quite old now. I guess he's 80s or 90s, and he's making films still. We watched one earlier this year, France versus the Robots. In 1999, they adapted Elio Vittorini's novel Conversations in Sicily. And the name of the film is Sicily. And it's appropriate because one of the things that Strobe Huillier often does when they adapt literary works, and they do this They did this a lot. They frequently adapted novels, plays, just anything, because they wanted to sort of retell the story in their own way. And what they often did a lot was strip it down, strip it down, strip it down, strip it down, and condense it into a package that they felt communicated what they wanted to communicate, turning these adaptations into very loose, adaptations indeed. But this is an anti-fascist novel written in 1942. Yeah, 1942. And it's about a man who has left Italy for a long time and has come home. And he has a series of conversations with people that he meets. And the significance of this story is one that is a critique of the fascist government of Italy, which, you know, you didn't do back then and, you know, get away with it very well. So, Strobouillet adapted Conversations in Sicily and just called it Sicilia with an exclamation point. And it is a short film, the way you just were talking about. It's a 66-minute movie.
Mm.
Because they take these conversations and pick the ones they like the best. and just give you chunks of them. There's a man, and he has been living in the United States, and he comes back to visit Sicily. And he has a series of conversations with a variety of people. He talks to an orange peddler at the beginning of the film. He talks to two police officers. He talks to a landowner who feels guilty about his role as a landowner. He talks at the very end, in a really wonderful finale, to a knife sharpener on the street. But primarily who he talks to is his own mother. In fact, 30-ish minutes of the 66-minute running time is devoted to a conversation in a room with his mother, where they dig into the past about what kind of mother she was, what kind of wife she was, how much she, has no regret about kicking her husband out after he became in love with another woman. And they have this conversation about fidelity where she says, "You know what? I would rather be treated like an old cow. And I would rather him have treated his many mistresses like old cows. But what he did instead was he wrote them poems."
Mm.
"And he had to go." And the son can't understand this. The son can't understand that it's one thing to just go, get some with a stranger, be done with it. It's quite another thing to keep seeing the stranger.
And woo them.
And woo them and write poetry. But this father, who you never see in the film, he was a charmer. And the wife finally got fed up. There's an ongoing recitation of foods that takes place in this film as well. From the orange peddler to especially the mother, where she goes on and on and on about all the foods they ate when she was a child, before the fascists, and what it meant to be, rich for half the month with, your money, and poor for half the month, and just living on snails, because that was the food of the poor people then. And then, finally, when he comes to the knife sharpener, more than one critic has written about the operatic qualities of the ending, specifically as it relates to Don Giovanni. There's a character in Don Giovanni that does a sort of list-based aria. I've written down the name. I've seen Don Giovanni. Wait, what's the name of the character? Leporablo? I'm screwing up his name. Listen, I don't speak Italian, but I am a big opera fan. Anyway,
that's true.
So James Quant, who edited the Bresson book that you gave me for Christmas a few years ago, he wrote about Cecilia for Artform. And the character's name is Leporello. Sorry, my handwriting, I couldn't even read my own handwriting. But he talks about how, you know, this ending is, the word he uses is exhilarating, because it is. In many ways, Strobrié films are very much like Bresson films in that the actors are told to speak in a very unnatural way, because very much like Bresson, Strobe and Huillet were all about the sound of the human voice being an equal element in the film with the visual elements. And so how they said it, the acting style, were they convincing actors or not, was sort of irrelevant to them. It was all about the quality of how they delivered the dialogue. Unlike Bresson, who made them all, you know, talk like this in a monotone for the entire film and never have any emotions at all. Sometimes, particularly in they're sort of films that are shot on landscapes, they will have just people sort of like shouting at each other, you know, across a field. And he says, they enumerate the joys and insults of life. And that's the ending of the movie. And for me, the point of it is, you know, yes, we are living in this horrible, horrible time. And yet, you can meet a stranger on the street and talk to them and have a 3-minute, 5-minute conversation that might not really be about anything other than just, isn't life great sometimes? Or isn't it also crappy sometimes? But mostly it can be great if we remember the stuff that we need to remember. I want to strongly recommend people watch this if they have never seen a Strobrié film, because I think it's the way in. I've seen about half a dozen of their movies at this point, and I will not lie, they can be work. And I love work. I love to be put to work in a film. And that's one of the things that you and I constantly argue about, that I love doing the homework. You know, I love seeing a movie that's too tough for me to deal with. I love going home and reading up as much as I can about it. Then I love to go watch it again so I can, like, learn. Because a film critic doesn't come to the job always knowing everything they need to know. And if you think you did, then you're a very bad critic. You learn as you go.
Sure.
And sometimes what you're learning is that you don't know enough yet to see something and really take away from it what needs to be taken away from it. Strobrié, Bresson, the real tough ones out there, they teach me, and it excites me when I get to be taught. So what makes this one different about the films that I've seen by them is that it has an accessibility and occasional punctuations of humor and joy and strangeness that give you sort of a foothold in ways that some of their more astringent films do not. It is streaming via Grasshopper. God, they should just do ads with us. The way I talk about them all the time, they should just be sponsoring us. And I chose to link to it through the Acropolis Cinema site. Acropolis is a Los Angeles traveling repertory situation that is currently, you know,
on hiatus.
They're just taking half the money on virtual cinemas.
Well, right.
If you click on their link and buy the ticket through them.
Yes. But if you have another one that's closer to you geographically or to your heart, you can choose that one.
So anyway, re-release, repertory, restorations, virtual cinemas, films that are too tough for me sometimes. Well, this one wasn't. I had a great time. Short 66 minutes. That counts as a feature.
It does.
Yeah.
It does.
Cecilia, with an exclamation point. Watch it.
A movie I want to stick a pin in until next week because I want you to watch it.
Yep.
Is Charm City Kings.
Oh, I really do want to watch Charm City
Kings. On HBO Max, which I loved, but we'll talk about that next week when you've seen it. And real quick.
It gave you your favorite song of the week.
It did.
Yeah.
Also, real quick, I want to talk about The War with Grandpa.
Oh, yeah. Listen, I watched enough of that to know. Well, go on.
Here's the thing. I have seen my share.
Are you talking about Hubie Halloween too?
I don't.
No, who cares?
I don't, who cares about Hubie Halloween?
Go watch Breakfast All Day. They talk about Hubie Halloween.
Yeah, I'm not talking about that again. I can't deal with that one. War with Grandpa. It's weird, and you can say that I've been beaten down, but I'll say this. I have seen a lot of despicable family comedies.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
The War with Grandpa isn't despicable. It's just aggressively mediocre.
Right, yeah.
It just happened. Its mediocrity is just thrown into sharp relief by the insanely overqualified cast in this film. This film stars Robert De Niro and Christopher Walken and Uma Thurman and Jane Seymour and Rob Riggle. Okay, Rob Riggle's maybe not insanely overqualified for this, but he's, you know, he's done better. The kid is Oakes Fegley.
He's also done worse.
He has, that's true also. The kid is Oakes Fegley, who was Pete in Pete's Dragon, and was the young Ansel Elgort in The Goldfinch.
Yeah.
Anyway, these
and
folks...
And who's now like 16.
Yes, this movie's been knocking around for a while.
They made this movie like 5 years ago or something.
This
was
made for Dimension Films, and then when Weinstein went under, it got sold back to the producers or whatever. It's, you know, it's nothing special, but I laughed a few times.
Right.
But ultimately, it ain't much. But I didn't hate it, because the movies that I hate are the ones that are just downright terrible and insulting, and you know, just like no one should be ashamed of this movie per se.
Right.
We will just, they're lucky though that we will all forget that this movie ever existed.
I'll tell you something though, I'm of the exact opposite opinion on films like this. These are the films I hate the most because they are nothing, because they aren't Hurricane Heist, they aren't, you know, Money Plane, which we haven't watched yet, right, but everyone tells me it's just bonkers. They aren't rotten. They aren't gutty, you know.
Right, but they aren't. But they aren't cynical, also though. Like, and cynical children's
entertainment. I think
films
like this are cynical because they're about nothing.
I think there is a whole other degree of cynicism in children's entertainment that is vile to watch.
Right,
and this is not that. It's just.
Fine. I only passed through the living room like 4 times when it was on, and I'd stop and I'd look and I'd be like, nope.
As you pointed out, it was a very brightly lit film.
Oh, yeah.
It looked
they
like,
all are.
It looked like something you would see on the Disney
They're
Channel.
They're meant to be watched on the Disney Channel.
Yeah.
Can I say one more thing about Cecilia?
Sure.
Cinematographer William Luchansky is responsible for the way this thing looks, and it looks beautiful. It's like gorgeous, contrasty black and white. This dude worked with Godard, Jacques Rivette, La Belle Noiseuse. Oh. He was a cinematographer for La Belle Noiseuse, for Le Pont du Nord, for so many, Joan the Maid. And...
Wait, which Joan the Maid? The Rivette or the...
Rivette.
Okay.
Yeah. And Shoah.
No.
He did all the Claude Lanzmann films, all that footage for Claude Lanzmann in the 70s,
mm-hmm.
In the 80s,
yeah.
And well, it started in the 70s.
Say, shooting
it began
in the
70s. And so every Claude Lanzmann documentary that you've seen that all came from that initial batch of hundreds and hundreds of hours of footage, including Shoah, shot by William Luchansky.
Okay.
Yeah. So it looks amazing.
All right. Letters.
Got them. Got some letters. Where are they? What did I do with them?
Oh, golly, Dave White.
Did I drop my AOL email? That's right. I have AOL email still. You got jokes? Take them somewhere else. Still works. I got a Gmail account, too, by the way. I'm current.
You'd have a flip
I'm
phone
modern.
If you could.
I'd have a jitterbug if I could. I'm modern and current. I have a Gmail, but I only use Gmail for business. I use AOL for, you know, the pleasure of reading these letters. Mr. Robert Kirby, who, by the way, Robert Kirby.
Yes.
Hello, Robert. Great cartoonist.
Talented cartoonist.
Robert Kirby.
Longtime fan.
Go check him out.
That he follows us on Patreon, I can never wrap my head around, because I've been a fan of his for years.
Me too. Yeah. But now we know him. So, yeah, Eddie's writing us. Thanks for the convo about boys in the band. Easily the best thing in it is the Michael character's apartment. Oh, yeah.
Oh,
for sure.
Gorgeous.
which was unbelievably awesome and would be insanely priced in the here and now. The verdict, Ryan Murphy pretty much blows. Those are Robert's words, not my own.
But we are not arguing.
I would never. Daniel says, so we get a lot of letters from some gays this week.
Well, you spent an hour talking about Boys in the Band.
That's right, gays. Here we go. I liked the first half of the Boys in the Band before Michael starts drinking. And it goes horribly wrong. Interestingly, I thought Brian in the American version of Queer as Folk was every bit as nasty as the characters in Boys. Oh, he for sure was.
Yeah, no question.
Yeah. He was. Ugh. They tried to sell that character as brutally honest, but he was really just a jerk. Yeah. And I thought less of the others for continuing to socialize with him. They even tried to sell him as a hero. I thought the characters on Will and Grace were similarly vicious. Remember on Will and Grace when What's-His-Face, who wrote Capote?
Fetterman.
Fetterman.
Yes.
Was a guest star as someone's boyfriend.
He was Will's boyfriend for like two or three episodes.
And they kept referring to this guy as fat.
Yeah.
And like, this dude weighs like 140. Really?
Soaking wet.
Yeah.
And he's fat the way Rhoda was fat, which is to say, not fat.
And you're like, I'm sorry, you keep calling this character fat, but is there another person with the same name in the episode who's fat that we haven't been introduced to yet?
Yeah.
Because I don't understand what I'm watching anymore. That will always stick with me.
Yeah.
Because I thought to myself,
the idea was that he was supposed to be bearish, but it's like, you cast Fetterman.
He had a little bit of a beard, maybe, like a five-day beard or something like that. It was insane. Like, and that's what gay was.
He wasn't gay fat. He wasn't gay TV fat. He was not anybody's fat.
He was not anyone's version of fat. Yeah. It was bananas.
Yeah.
I think they may have put like a little pillow under his sweater or something. It was like this square little throw pillow.
Yeesh.
Julia says, I really enjoyed your discussion of the evolution of queer friendship groups in a parallel to the conquest of civil rights and visibility. In my night job, since my day job has been taken over by online teaching, I do research, and one of the most interesting observations in my field has been about the co-situating potential of LGBTQ dating apps. LGBTQ dating apps and their simultaneous community creating and community dismantling potential.
No, that's true.
I just find it fascinating how structural or technological variables can affect not just people's relationships, but also their overall existence and perception of such existence. Yeah. The more that technology becomes part of your day-to-day life, the more your relationships could be entirely online.
Oh, yeah.
With people you've never met before, and yet you might still feel close to them. You know,
true.
You might still feel like that's part of your, community.
But also, I think in a more literal sense, we've seen in gay neighborhoods everywhere, first bookstores and then bars kind of collapsing because of, online shopping and dating apps.
Yeah. Okay, here's a pretty long one.
Okay.
Should we save it? Let's save this one. It's actually really long. Let's save it for the next time because I want to give it what it needs. I want to give it the time to stretch
out. There's two other ones.
There's another one that's a list from Fernando.
Yes.
Fernando says, hello. Autumn is my favorite time of year, especially as I was born and raised in New England, Connecticut.
Oh.
Now that I live in Florida, it's hard to get into the autumnal spirit.
Mm.
Listening to your last Linoleum Knife, Dave trying to get Alonzo into the Halloween-themed mood, I don't like horror movies, but I love Halloween/fall-themed movies. I was hoping you can knife my go-to films. Thank you for keeping me sane in these crazy times. And I love everything you guys do. Thank you, Fernando.
Oh, thanks.
A bottle of Coquito, which is better than eggnog, in my opinion, will be shipped by early December for your enjoyment.
Ooh,
I'm excited about that.
Very much so.
Is there booze? Is there booze-a-hall?
I think there is booze-a-hall in a Coquito, yes.
But what kind? Will I like it? I don't drink.
Well,
I mean, I have like a glass of
wine. You'll try it.
a beer. You know, one of those that dinner time, you know. I'm not out here knocking them down.
It's the holidays.
True.
Enjoy a libation.
Time to go cling, ding, 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 cling, ding, 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 ding.
Exactly. There's some cold duck in this piece.
Creature from the Black Lagoon.
Fun.
I love Creature from the Black Lagoon. Yeah. The very first time I saw Creature from the Black Lagoon, it was in this really crisp 3D print at a college. Yeah. And it was so much fun.
Nice.
Young Frankenstein.
Oh, the best.
Yeah. Clue.
Fun.
The Frighteners from 1996.
Walked out of it.
Yeah, me too. I was with you. I didn't really like it at all. And maybe I should give it another chance. Yeah, I don't know. Halloween Town, 1998. Never saw it.
The Youngs love that one. The Youngs, people in their 30s. Right.
Well, that's young compared to us.
Exactly. Yeah. But no, that's one of those things like Hocus Pocus, where if you were a kid when it came out, that is one of your October go-tos, but it completely missed us.
Practical Magic.
Dave's favorite flu movie.
Oh, Sandy Bullock. She's my... Look.
And Nicole.
Listen, Sandra Bullock and me. We go back like Mariah and ODB. All right? That's how it is.
You go back to what? Love Potion number 9?
All the way back.
Okay.
Nothing gets in between our love.
Fair enough.
Yeah. I'll watch any terrible, stupid movie with her in it. I didn't watch... Was she in Bird Box?
Yes, she was.
I didn't watch Bird Box.
Okay. Yeah. Well, then I guess you won't watch any stupid
movie. Yeah, well, I watch almost any stupid, terrible
movie. Did you see the one where she is the nurse and Chris O'Donnell is Ernest Hemingway?
Yeah. Okay. So don't step to me.
I'm just testing.
All right.
But I clearly, you've passed.
I forget the name of it, but I saw it.
In Love and War, I want to say.
That's right. Something like that, yeah.
Not to be confused with Wrestling Ernest Hemingway, which came out around the same time.
Not to be confused with that one with Anthony Hopkins and Deborah Winger, where he was C.S. Lewis.
Shadowlands. And
same time frame.
Yes.
But I was like, oh my God. Like, another movie where Deborah Winger dies at the end, and I'm like, just get it over with. Just do it. Be done already.
It's like you can't hire Deborah Winger if she doesn't expire beautifully in Act 3.
I love Deborah Winger, but oh man.
I would like to see her make it to the closing credits for once, yes.
Sleepy Hollow, 1999. Yeah. Cool. And Coco from 2017.
Oh, good one.
So we're not going to give you The Frighteners because we walked out of it and we don't know any better, probably. But you listen, you're 90%.
Absolutely.
Do we still get the Coquito?
I hope so.
I would like
and
it.
And I'll tell you, you know, somebody was asking recently about like favorite autumn movies and stuff. Yeah. And a movie that was, I mean, it is a horror film, but that has really, really great autumn colors and feelings and sensations is the recent Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark.
Oh, yeah.
That movie has more orange leaves in it than like... the entire Hallmark Channel Fall Harvest series.
Well, that's a lot of fake leaves.
Yeah.
But not as much fake everything else as a Hallmark movie,
well,
I guess.
That's a whole other thing.
It sure is.
All right, so we're saving the other letter for next time?
We are. Okay. It's very long, and I want to give it... I don't want to rush through it because I'm in a hurry to make dinner.
Okay.
Which is kind of what's happening in my brain right now.
Okay. All right. Fine. Well, just as a reminder, everybody, we do have a Patreon page at patreon.com/linoleumknife.
Yes.
We've got tons of extra content, including Linoleum Knife Presents More Linoleum Knife, where we dig into films like What She Said, The Art of Pauline Kael.
LKTV, which is a podcast about television. Linoleum Knife and Fork, which is a podcast about food. We have a very special guest coming up.
We do.
On Linoleum Knife and Fork.
The kind you want to subscribe for.
Yeah, you totally do. And then Linoleum Nights, where we talk about how much we hate the president, and then we use the F word.
Yes.
A lot.
You don't want to miss that. Plus, special hangouts and other fun things that we do that is exclusive to our subscribers. So, yeah, patreon.com/linoleumknife. Thanks for listening. Check out our friends on the internet. First, please check out my other shows, but also take a listen to the Critically Acclaimed Network, everything that Bibbs and Whitney are up to over there, as well as Schmoes Know, Dennis Enun with Dennis Hensley, The Comics Canon, Sewers of Paris, All Things Cozy, Deck the Hallmark, Fat Guys at the Movies, the Criterion cast, and Secretly Timid. You can subscribe to this show for free at Apple Podcasts. Leave us a 5-star review there, please. We'll read it on the show, and it helps people find us. You can also leave us positive feedback in the many places that we stream, including Spotify and Google Play, Amazon Podcasts, Stitcher Radio, CastBox, Podbean. You can follow us at LinoleumCast on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook, and you can drop us a line at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com. We're so glad you joined us this week. We'll be back next time with more, and until then,
goodbye.